Hi everyone, and welcome to the UBS Global Research Pod Hub, a podcast that tackles the pivotal questions on topics that are shaping today's world. I'm Beatrice Allen, equity analyst at UBS, leading the UK mid-cap franchise, and I am excited to be hosting this podcast where I'll be joined by a few of my colleagues to discuss some of the biggest cross-sector trends this year: Gen AI, the slowing consumer, and the upcoming US election. So let's dive right in with our first topic, which is also one of the most talked about themes of 2023, but whose prevalence has not waned, and that is generative AI. I'm joined by Michael Briest, Head of European Technology Research at UBS, who was an early mover on this topic. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So it doesn't really feel like it, especially not for you probably, given how much you've talked about it, but generative AI as a topic is pretty new on the scene. It only really broke into popular consciousness less than 2 years ago. So my first question, what have been the biggest things investors in the market have got right? And arguably more interestingly, what have they got wrong in terms of the initial expectations here?
I think the excitement that accompanied the initial launch of tools like ChatGPT, DALL-E and Midjourney was in part a result of the immediacy of the response these tools provided the user and how easy they were for any person to interact with. Given the time, cost and top levels of human intellect that went into creating the models, I think there was initially a view that the model creators would be able to extract the most value from the technology. However, as open source versions of various large language models proliferated and showed themselves to be nearly as good, or in some cases as good as the proprietary models, that view has shifted. I think I'd phrase it as the early model owners are clearly part of the value creation process, but they aren't seen as some sort of gatekeeper to the technology. I think in some sectors, there was also an extreme aversion to the perceived risks from generative AI, such as in BPO, outsourcing, and elements of media. Quite reasonably, there was a fear that new entrants based purely on Gen AI models would displace incumbents overnight. In a gold rush, the smart investor always looks for the picks and shovel manufacturers, and clearly the likes of some of the semiconductor companies and cloud hyperscalers were identified as winners early on, and that's proved to be very successful.
Really interesting. And there are obviously a lot of moving parts here, and there aren't really that many precedents we can pull to kind of use to accurately predict the developments. But in your mind, you know, what stage of generative AI adoption are we at right now, and how should we expect that to develop from here?
Yes, it's there's a lot of data points, but not a lot of structured information out there. UBS Evidence Lab track earnings call data can search for themes such as AI. The initial enthusiasm hasn't dipped, with over a quarter of earnings calls last quarter including some reference to AI, and actually over 10% to generative AI specifically. Talk is cheap, as they say. When we look at spending, Accenture, the largest listed IT services company in the world, reported $900 million in generative AI-related bookings last quarter. That's double what it was two quarters previously, and over 4% of the total. However, like a lot of the industry peers, the message was that most projects were relatively small, and the AI part can only really be added effectively after a lot of hygiene has been applied to data, with data typically moving into the cloud and secured. UBS Evidence Lab also surveyed 125 organizations on their adoption plans in May. It was great to see all of them saying they were at least at the investigative stage, but the average level of spend was only around $1.6 million for this year and expected to double next. We're seeing lots of discrete applications being built or adopted, but taking something enterprise-wide takes time and diligence. Going forwards, we fully expect to see adoption grow, but the need to get the building blocks of a clean, consistent data model where data is secure will take time.
Yeah, lots to look out for. And we've mostly focused on kind of corporate activities and investment here, but you know, given the scale of the opportunity and of the risks that come with this topic, government and regulators clearly need to be involved here as well. How have they acted to shape the adoption of generative AI so far?
Yes, there was always an expectation that regulators would take a keen interest in the threats as well as opportunities arising from generative AI, given the potential for bias in decision making and the risks from the technology related to deepfakes and hallucinations. The European Union adopted an AI Act in May this year that will apply from 2026. And for instance, that requires that content that's either generated or modified with the help of AI, such as images, audio, or video, will need to be labelled as such. While there's nothing in the federal status in the US as of now, Colorado has come in with a similar ruling in May as well around discrimination. There's also a new bill actually in the US proposing to ban digital replicas of real people, but that's at an early stage. So in summary, the legislation is work in progress. And we have also seen examples of litigation regarding the use of content for training from the media and music industry. I'd end by saying it remains an area investors will need to keep an eye on.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much, Michael. That's been really, really interesting.
You're welcome.
I'm joined next by Susanna Pusch, head of luxury goods at UBS, who has been flagging the risk of weakening demand in her sector since September last year, well ahead of others. Now, Susanna, I understand luxury, while certainly macro-linked, does also have its own cycle compared with other retail or consumer-exposed sectors. Can you walk us through the dynamics here?
Thank you, Beatrice, for having me today. So we first turned more cautious on the luxury sector already back in September last year, when we came back from holidays and observed a sharp slowdown in trends globally. Then, having returned from our annual China trip later the same month, we got worried incrementally about the Chinese consumer. Over the past year, and especially in the last two quarters, the market has come to a wider realization that luxury consumption is under pressure almost everywhere in the world, with most companies seeing slowing momentum despite an easier comparable basis. We often remind investors that while the sector is subject to macro risks, it is important to remember that the sector also follows its own cycles, which tend to be driven by more idiosyncratic factors. Following the boom cycle over the past 7 to 8 years of double-digit sales growth, we are of the view that the sector has now entered a more moderated growth period that could last some time before the brands figure out the new ways to excite the consumers.
Really interesting. And so within this kind of broad global dynamic, are we seeing specific trends between regions at all?
Maybe before answering your question, I would just note that within the luxury industry, it is more representative to look at trends by consumer clusters instead of regions. That's because historically, roughly 40% of the sector sales has come from tourism. Basically, people shop luxury when they travel. So when it comes to various clusters, the Americans were the first to slow already in Q3 2022. Followed by the Europeans with a one-year lag in Q3 last year, and then finally the Chinese consumers that started to decelerate more from Q4 or Q1 this year. Q2 earnings season showed us very diverging trends by cluster. So on one hand, the Chinese consumer continued to slow sequentially and seems to be also showing the same trend in the third quarter, while the Europeans and Americans stabilized quarter over quarter, yet have not picked up substantially despite the fact that the comparable basis is easier. So this is why when we speak to investors, we often mention that the setup for H2 of this year could be very interesting, and we would prefer companies that are enjoying a more broad-based growth and are not overly reliant on just one consumer nationality in this uncertain environment.
Okay, great. So maybe we could dig more into that H2 story. What should we be looking out for in H2 across luxury?
So we continue to believe that the overall consumer sentiment in the luxury sector remains rather muted for H2, with consumers taking more time to think before actually making the purchases, which drives a clear divergence between brands, especially those very high-end positioned and those more exposed to the aspirational consumer. At the start of the year, I think people were hoping for a meaningful rebound in H2, with perhaps high single-digit sales growth, which currently has become less and less likely as we progress through the year. As I touched on earlier, so far we are still waiting for some green shoots from the various consumer cohorts, and we are still not seeing any meaningful trends that are sustainable to call the bottom.
Brilliant. Thanks so much, Susanna.
Thank you.
So moving on to our final topic for today, it's probably the biggest of them all, the US election. We all knew going into 2024 that it would be a political bonanza with half the world's population invited to vote in 76 elections across the globe. But at the start of the year, the most consequential of these elections from a market perspective, the US presidential race, looked very different. We have a new Democratic candidate, new running mates on both sides, certainly some new campaign strategies. And I think it's fair to say that there have been enough plot twists to warrant a Hollywood serial drama at this point. Trying to navigate the stock market around that kind of news flow volatility has been a challenge for everyone in the last few months on top of a tough earnings season. So I'm really pleased to have our chief strategist, Banu Baweja, here to help us through this. You've obviously written extensively on the topic. I'm super excited to dig into your thoughts. Thank you for joining us.
Pleasure.
I'm just going to kick straight off in the deep end. What do you think the market is currently pricing in terms of the US election result?
It's a little difficult to tell when you look at stock markets and you think about the sectors that benefit from a Republican victory and those that benefit from a Democrat victory. And if you look at the relative price performance, at one point the market was pointing to, I wouldn't say a near certainty, but you know, about a 70-75% probability of a Democrat, of a Republican victory, pardon me. And since then, it's come off a little bit. So it is broadly mirroring the polls. The market, however, is still thinking, if you look at just the stock prices, they are thinking a Republican victory is more likely than a Democrat presidency. When you think about future earnings, and you think about pre-tax and post-tax earnings, you can actually back out from that and implied tax rate. And the implied tax rate that you can back out from that is actually even lower than we are today. So 21% tax rate in the US, what you can back out for 25 and 26 is close to 19%. That would suggest not just a Republican president, but a Republican sweep, because that's what it would take for Donald Trump to be able to cut taxes significantly. So I would say that both stock market prices, but also the earnings expectations, their base case is a Republican president and I would say a red sweep. So a Democrat win would be the surprising event, even though the status quo right now would be that you get a Democrat president. In political terms, in financial terms, the market already expects a Republican president.
Really interesting. And so in the event of a red sweep, which the market is pricing in, what happens? Do you think we return to kind of play out the same way as a post-2016?
I think it's very unlikely that the 2016 template plays out again, because in 2016, you had very different starting points of the economy and very different starting points of risk premium, right? So we need to go into a little bit of detail out here. The US economy in 2016 was an early to mid-cycle. There are various ways of measuring it, the unemployment gap, or where consumer expectations for the future are relative to where they are for the present, the various ways of measuring it, but whichever way you slice it, the US economy was in mid-cycle or early cycle in 2016. It is late cycle today, which means that there's no runway for an unfettered expansion without inflation. So at this minute, if the US economy was to expand, you will see greater inflation and the Fed will not be able to cut rates as aggressively, which basically means that if you're late cycle, then you're probably close to your top in terms of earnings estimates. More importantly, so that's the economic cycle, but more importantly, if you think about the risk premium or the risk cycle, you already priced very, very tight in terms of risk premium. You could actually say that in simple English by saying valuations are very high. But it's not just equity valuations, it's also FX vol is much lower than it was at that time. Credit spreads are way tighter than they were at that time. So all of this contributes to many of these markets being quite hot, quite highly valued at this time, whereas they weren't in 2016. So when Donald Trump came in, A, it was a big surprise. B, taxes came off in a big way. C, valuations were cheap and the market and the economy was early cycle. None of that is true today. Investors are not paying attention. And that's why I would argue that if you see Donald Trump coming in as president, there could be sort of just as a Pavlovian response from investors, you could see a little bit of a rally. But we would suggest we would be fading that rally because the starting points in the economic cycle and the risk premium cycle are dramatically different.
Okay. And so, as you say, there's a little bit of a delta going on between the political probabilities and the ones that are being priced in. So let's take the political probabilities. What happens if Harris wins?
So it depends on the makeup of the Congress. There is a reasonably high probability that the Senate flips Republican. And if that's the case, then a lot of what she wants to do, she may not be able to get through. And perhaps this is a damning indictment of American politics, that could be actually the best case scenario for the markets, where politicians are not able to get through their policies and you have policy stasis. The market will probably celebrate that again. A sad state of affairs. But in that case, she won't be able to get much done. But if the Senate is Democrat, then there's a very high probability that corporate taxes will go up. I think income taxes for individuals, for people earning below 400K, will remain low. I think that's a given. There's bipartisan agreement on that. But for corporates, that's the big question. So taxes could go up to as much as 28%. And then we will see the exact opposite of what we saw in 2017, when in 2017 you saw a massive markup in earnings expectations for the future. Here you will see 12-month forward earnings expectations come down by 7 to 8%. So there could be a pretty big hit. And that's why I said to you earlier, and you know, when you asked me about whether the market is pricing in Trump correctly, I said to you that the market may respond quite aggressively initially, but that would be a fade. I'm thinking it's almost the opposite under a Democrat White House, where the market will initially be very worried about higher taxes, but then quickly price that in and move on. Because I think under a Democrat president, we don't know that much about Kamala Harris's policies. This is a very policy light election campaign so far. But what we do know is that Trump's policies are probably more negative for the growth inflation mix than Kamala Harris's policy. So I think the market will respond positively after an initial shock under a Democrat White House. The market will respond positively. And it's possible, I think it's likely, that on a 12-month horizon, the market is higher under a Democrat White House than under a Republican one.
Wow, that's incredibly helpful. Thank you so much, Banu. All eyes ahead to the 5th of November, I guess.
You bet.
Thanks for listening, all. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to follow us and share UBS Global Research Pod Hub with friends or colleagues.
This content has been prepared by UBS AG, its subsidiaries and/or affiliates, and is purely informational in nature. It is not investment research and does not contain an investment recommendation nor investment or professional advice. It is not an offer or solicitation to engage in any investment activity, and you should seek your own financial, tax, and legal advice before engaging in any such activity. UBS has no responsibility to you in relation to this content. It has no regard to your personal circumstances or investment objectives, and receiving it does not imply any form of client relationship with UBS for any legal, regulatory, or tax purpose. This content is not intended for distribution into any jurisdiction where to do so would be contrary to law or regulation. UBS does not accept any liability over the content of such material or reliance upon any information contained herein. The views and opinions expressed by any guest speaker or third party are not those of UBS. Accordingly, UBS does not accept any liability over any such views and opinions expressed by such persons. This content is the valuable intellectual property of UBS, and UBS specifically prohibits the redistribution of it in whole or in part without its prior written permission. UBS 2024, the key symbol, and UBS are among the registered and unregistered trademarks of UBS. All rights reserved.